reflections on the theme of the day. And it's being recorded, so I'd really invite you to primarily be listening rather than recording your own version of it. I think it may serve for some to write things down as they go, but generally it's really useful to just be listening as fully as one can. It's even interesting, the habit and urge, and it's understandable and nothing wrong with it, to record things. Generally it's for an assumed future. And so the moment we're doing it, we're already slightly in relationship to what's going to come, rather than what is here. And so although it's a perfectly valid and valuable and crucial thing, of course, human beings and our culture would be in a very different place if we couldn't record things to carry forward. There's another way in which it's part of the tendency easily just to be leaning forward into life, not quite where we are in terms of what we're in relationship with. And so part of the kind of the noticing the tendency to lean forward is balanced or is checked by just the acknowledging of okay, something stops, something ends, something pauses here, and the invitation over the period of lunchtime to just notice that. And then likewise through the period of practice just now, the different forms. Again, the intention behind what we're doing being definitive of what we're doing. Intention in this case to notice that. Often sort of not fully acknowledged, not fully included reality of endings, of change, of impermanence. And yet from kind of what I was speaking about earlier in the day, one might get the impression that it's sort of all bad news and, you know, gosh, you know, should all be a bit long-faced hearing about this. And it's not the case at all. And I'd like to just reflect on that a little. The reality is that any space we're in, including this one, would be very crowded if it wasn't for the fact that people move on. If everyone that had ever been here was still here, this would be a rather different event today. And, you know, again, these things are obvious, but just to recognize, oh, the fact of acknowledging impermanence also gives us a lot of space to deal with that which is difficult. The flip side of what I spoke about this morning, where we are assuming permanence in our struggle with experience, or I can't deal with it, I don't want to deal with it, I don't like it, so much of that comes out of the way we've projected it into the future. And just the remembering, just the noticing, oh, this is not forever. And even if this appears or seems to be forever, this is not forever. You know, either the experience is impermanent or me experiencing it is impermanent. One way or another, it doesn't go on forever. That actually that gives some space. It gives some support to the capacity we have to make room for that which is difficult. And a kind of a contemplation from one of the sort of much-loved teachers in Thailand that I knew of. He would say in the 20th century, it was teacher of one of my teachers, Ajahn Damodaro. And he would say, with regard to almost anything, you know, this too is impermanent. This too shall pass. Just as a framework to meet things. Ben anicca due is the phrase. This too is impermanent. And it's just kind of interesting as a lens, again, to pick up and just see, so how do I relate to the nice sun coming through the window, or the noise of the traffic, or the whatever's going on, this too, and even settling into the meditation. And there's a couple of reasons why I suggested we do what we did just now, but one of the elements of it was the fluidity of the shape and the form and even the group, that it's not fixed and it's not necessarily staying the same way. And just letting that be a little bit more to the foreground, as well as releasing our tendency to resist or struggle with that which is difficult. What it also does, it actually opens the heart's tenderness and sensitivity. Because we're not in that kind of shielded, fixed position of this is how it is, which we slightly withdraw from contact and relationship when we're in. When we know how it is, why do I need to pay attention to it? Why should I bother? When we don't know how it is, actually we have to pay attention to it to find out what's going to happen next. And from that attitude, of course, there's a great degree of sensitivity. And in that sensitivity, there are many gifts. One of the elements of what impermanence offers us is that it's an essential ingredient or a foundation, really, of what we enjoy in the sense of beauty, what we love, that touches us. That, we can look at flowers and amazing, they're delightful. Have you ever gone into a restaurant or somewhere and not been able to tell quite for sure if that was really a flower on the table? You know, because they make them look so good, and they're some smart one, they even add a drop of some kind of perfume to them, they smell good. And you can't actually tell that it's not a flower just by looking at it. But often there's something that's missing and we can't quite name what it is. And we can feel the absence of something even though the appearance is pretty close to perfect. And it's something to do with it's not something that's on the way to falling apart in the way that a real flower is. And a perfect flower that doesn't have anything curling up or any leaves going brown or any petals looking a little ragged is a very brief occurrence for it to be in that state of perfection. Mostly, it's somewhere on the way to being less than as together. And there's something about that, that it's actually the very fact of its temporariness that gives that quality to it that I think we love, that we resonate with, that we appreciate. And it's like we go to, again, a pretty universal thing that people appreciate, beings appreciate, human beings at least, to see a sunset. And, you know, you go and look and the beautiful colours of golds or reds or oranges or maybe even, you know, purples. And you see it and it can be like, wow, how amazing, how lovely. Come on in. How lovely to see this. And yet imagine if it really didn't change. It's sort of like, oh yeah, that's nice. Yeah, I can enjoy that. And, you know, what's for dinner? Is probably the next thought. Because they keep changing, because a sunset keeps changing and eventually disappears, it can capture the attention, it can grab us. And there's some way in which we really resonate with impermanence, where it touches our hearts. This changeable, not fixed nature of things. Its fluidity, its dissolving, transparent dissolvability is part of it actually what moves us. It's part of why we feel things deeply. When I mentioned Catherine earlier, some of you know her, she comes here sometimes, I think. And when we got married, we opened our marriage ceremony, which is a pretty alternative and probably strange animal as a thing that we created. But we opened it with Catherine singing a song based on an Aztec prayer, of which the basic refrain was, and that was, only for a short time life has loaned us to each other. And it was interesting because quite a lot of the friends and family who weren't, you know, Dharma practitioners, that thought this was a bit weird. You know, when you start a marriage with commenting on the fact that that actually this is just a temporary thing, only for a short while. And yet for us, it was really clear that naming to that, adverting to that, bringing that consciously to the center and the beginning of what we were doing was actually to feel the real preciousness of it, to feel, oh gosh, how amazing, precisely because it's not forever, that this could be so, that we could be here even at all. There's a place in the monastery, the Buddhist monastery in Chithurst, Chittaviveka, in West Sussex, where I like to go. And there's a little plaque at one point under a bush. There's a number of them now, but this has been there ever since I've been going, so it's been there a long time. And it's got a little inscription, which is, I think, a haiku. I don't remember the name of the author of the haiku. It looks like a Japanese name. But it basically, it says this. The cherry blossoms cover the hillsides for but a few days. Any longer, and we would not treasure them so. And underneath, it's got the name, Little Sam, and a single date. And there's something about that that speaks to me, and even when I remember it, having done this many times and seeing it many times over years, the sense of the preciousness of something is not reduced by the briefness of its duration, but it's actually enhanced. A life that, from what I read, was just for one day, was still so precious to the people who loved that being, that life, and more so because of its impermanence, its shortness of visiting. So there's something again. That there's something about this quality of things changing, of disappearing, of dissolving, that gives them something of beauty and something of preciousness. Preciousness is related to scarcity. If we were here forever, it would be hard to relate to it in the same way, wouldn't it? But we don't necessarily fully relate to it in the truth of just how impermanent and precious, therefore, it is. It's precisely because it could be taken away that it's of value. Things that can't be taken away, we don't really pick them up with our heart in the same way. So there's another element that's really important about this reflection, what it offers, or this, it's not just a reflection. The reflection connects us with what's true and what that truth has to offer us in this dimension of seeing impermanence, understanding it. What I've noticed and what I see really clearly is when we take our experience as permanent, as fixed, it's very closely connected with the way we take it to be mine. It's like ownership has the sense of I've got it and I can keep it until I let it go. Because that's what ownership is, isn't it? I get to be in charge of it. When we see that I'm not in that relationship to it, then it's not really mine in the same way. It's not mine if I can't get to keep it. It's just, as I said, it's like, you know, it's being loaned to me for a while. And one of the things we do with that is when it's mine, we start to shift or slip very easily into an attitude of taking it for granted and then wanting to improve it. It's a basic mechanism, and I can illustrate it again, that story I told at the beginning of staying with some friends in this house that they'd bought. It was very interesting to me how we moved in. I thought, wow, this is lovely. Look, it's got a nice space here and a nice room there. And our friends moved in. I thought, oh, this is really nice. We can move that wall. We could put one of these in here. We could extend that over there. And it was very interesting because it was theirs. They could do all those things because we were just temporary there and we knew it. We didn't have that response to it. Now, I have a place now, and yes, we do have those thoughts to it. So I'm not saying it's good or bad in terms of that as an absolute, but to see, oh, what happens when I don't see impermanence, when I don't see temporariness, I very quickly have a sense of permanence, ownership, and control. They go together. And if we understand that actually, we're living in rental accommodation. This body, this mind, this heart. We're not so needing, I don't think, for it to be perfect. We don't need to fix it or upgrade it or renovate it all the time. Sure, we might do some of that. But we might actually also just really receive the good fortune and blessing and be conscious of how lucky we are that we've got somewhere to live at all. And the fact that, well, it could be a mansion when it's just two up, two down. Well, hey, there's enough room for me in here. So what would it be like if we were to live our life from a place where we were close to this, to what this means? If this reflection, this contemplation was something that was alive in us, for us, and to us in an ongoing way. There's a beautiful stanza from the Diamond Sutra, one of the teachings of the Mahayana, the northern and say later school of Buddhism. And it goes like this. And the translation I like is slightly old English, but thus you should look upon this fleeting world, a drop of dew, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a mirage, a phantom, and a dream. And that sort of flow of images for me, a drop of dew, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a phantom, a mirage, and a dream. It's like, actually, there's a flickering lamp in there as well, I just remembered, but anyway. That sense of evanescence, of fluidity, of something very, like all of those could be something very powerful in their impact, but they're also ungraspable, fluid. Something about that gives, I think, a real support to the heart, to inform us as to how we need to live. How we need to live. In order to live in harmony with the life that we're in the midst of. And the fundamental wisdom of impermanence, the fundamental implication, significance, is very much in line with what we find is at the heart of, you know, what meditative practice asks of us, and what the Buddha's teachings point to is as the core orientation for actually freeing the heart. And it's to do with not attaching to or resisting the content of our experience. Those things that are pleasant, positive, agreeable, flattering, we tend to take hold of. And when we see they're not permanent, they're not forever, we can't really do so successfully. It makes no sense to grasp hold of. And it's natural from the seeing of transience that we actually begin to let go. It's not something we do because we think it's a good idea. It's the natural response of the heart, actually. And likewise, those things that are difficult, painful, unwished for, disagreeable, and embarrassing, of which there are many in life. Rather than resisting them, rather than pushing them away, rather than being unwilling to include them, when we see that these things too are not forever, then it's much more, again, a natural response to just let them be. To not need to push away, to not need to take hold of, to not be defining our experience or ourselves according to the moving content of experience. And that doesn't mean standing back off it. This is a common misunderstanding of the teaching of the Buddha, I think, and sometimes plays out in various sort of orientations within meditation practice that it's about somehow, oh, it's all kind of impermanent and it's not very sort of satisfactory, so I won't really have anything to do with all of that. That's absolutely not what's being suggested. And it's certainly not what conduces to deep fulfillment. But to actually be intimate with life, to be close to experience, to be touched by it, but in the touch knowing it's just this and just for now. And Blake speaks of this in a lot less words than I can manage to say it. So in one of his, I think, again, well-known and much-loved poems, he writes, he says, "He who binds himself to a joy does the winged life destroy. He who kisses the joy as it flies lives on in eternity's sunrise." An incredible, for me, wealth of wisdom and beautiful teaching in that. He, she, who bind themselves to a joy. When we take hold of that which we love, which uplifts the heart, it destroys the winged life, the sense of life that is free, that is fluid, that is able to move. And we can see that if we take hold of, if we squeeze hold of, if we grab hold of something we love, we actually lose the contact with what we love. Because we actually start coming from the place of fear rather than appreciation, or craving and the wish to hold on to, rather than the actual contact with that which we love. We lose that in the grasping. And again, this is a primary mechanism that we learn to explore and understand in terms of the practicing of the Buddha's teaching. And to kiss the joy as it flies, it's a beautiful image for me. That sense of to be intimate with something sweet and lovely in life, to be intimate with it, to kiss the joy as it flies, to live on in eternity's sunrise. So Blake is seeing and understanding this, pointing to the fact that that ability to be intimate with something transient and yet beautiful is actually to be very close to the understanding in which really eternity's sunrise is, say the dawn of the timeless, the realization, the understanding of something that is profound and transformative in our seeing of it and our knowing of it. That quality of intimacy with that which is ungraspable and yet precious, which is actually the truth of each moment. It's ungraspable and precious together. To be intimate with that is to be close to discovering something, to live in eternity's sunrise. She who binds herself to a joy does the winged life destroy. She who kisses the joy as it flies lives on in eternity's sunrise. It's always striking when someone can say so much with so few words. So we're asked to make peace with this, to see it, to really incorporate into one's life what the implications of the seeing are. To not try and control or fix that which is uncontrollable and unfixable, to allow life to be the fluidity that it is, and to inhabit it wholeheartedly and fully in that condition. When we see that things are changing, impermanent, and therefore unable to give us lasting satisfaction, as the Buddha is regularly quoted as saying, there's a piece that could be added to this for Westerners, I think, which is not only are experiences unable to give us lasting satisfaction because they're changing, they are also unable to be an obstruction to lasting satisfaction for exactly the same reason. No experience can give it to us or do it for us in and of itself, but equally no experience is somehow able to absolutely prevent or obstruct us from that which we are most deeply interested in. And whatever we call that in terms of satisfaction, peace, happiness, well-being, truth, God, life. Experience in and of itself doesn't do that. And seeing that, knowing that, one starts to withdraw the in a way the power that we give to experience. We withdraw the assumption that is in this, it lies the problem or the solution. While still, of course, the many things that need to be attended to that can be problems and can be solutions, all that realm of living and operating in the world continues to have its place and make sense, but at another level, to not hold on. Because all holding on comes out of that unseen and unquestioned belief that this can do it for me. Or this is what's it happening for me? Whatever it is that we're most interested in. And so the Buddha, having begun his seeking, his journey, his exploring, with the question about, you know, why should I, who am subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, why should I seek and pursue and spend my life chasing other things which are also subject to that? He comes to the understanding and the offering of the teaching where he says, through his own understanding and discovery, he says, there is that which is not subject to birth, aging, sickness and death. If there were not this, there would be no deliverance from that which is subject to birth, aging, sickness and death. And his teaching is an invitation to understand this, to discover this for ourselves. To not imagine that it's something, and nor to imagine that it's nothing. Because either of those positions would be incomplete. At the heart of it, the truth of impermanence reminds us to let go and to let be. And to really be present in the vital immediacy of the life that we have that is here. Right now. And see what that reveals. The fundamental freedom is born of not holding on to or resisting. And seeing where we find ourselves or what we find in that condition. Not so complicated and yet equally not so easy to execute. And yet possible for us as human beings, absolutely. So I'd like to finish these reflections with a poem by Jennifer Wellwood entitled The Dakini Speaks. And a Dakini is, say, a feminine embodiment of wisdom in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Probably has some similarities to the realm of angels in the Western and Christian cosmology, but I'm not drawing an absolute parallel there. Anyway, the title, The Dakini Speaks. My friends, let's grow up. Let's stop pretending we don't know the deal here. Or if we haven't noticed, let's wake up and notice. Look, everything that can be lost will be lost. It's simple. How could we have missed it for so long? Let's grieve our losses fully like ripe human beings. But please, let's not act so shocked by them. Let's not act so betrayed, as though life had broken her sacred promise to us. Impermanence is life's only promise to us. And she keeps it with ruthless impeccability. To a child she seems cruel, but she is only wild. And her compassion exquisitely precise. Brilliantly penetrating, luminous with truth, she strips away the unreal, to show us the real. This is the true ride. Let's give ourselves to it. Let's stop making deals for a safe passage. There isn't one anyway, and the cost is too high. We are not children anymore. The true human adult gives everything for what cannot be lost. Let us dance the wild dance of no hope. So let's just sit quietly for a few moments together. And may we all live more and more fully in tune with the truth of change and impermanence. Be at peace in a world that keeps moving. And to come to know, to realize the Dharma, which is unchanging for our own welfare and for the welfare of all beings.